I think one thing, too, and you can tell me if I'm wrong on the smoke show, but I think what Scoggins, which, by the way, what a name is, what kind of name is that? Isn't that awesome? Scoggins. It just sounds like he should have a kilt on. And anyway, he said that it wouldn't even cost our government any extra money. Is that right? The money's already out there in the ether, not being maybe used as well as it could be. And so essentially what one is asking is take some of that money that's, you know, and put it toward electrifying Africa. So please see them. They'll be at the connection point. They have really cool wristbands, and they have a lot of great information. And what they really hope for is that from our region, I think, that we could get 50 letters. And I told him I thought we could get 50 letters from our church. And you know, the rest of the region, we can do that. So, yeah, so I'm going to count those of you clapping. You're writing a letter. So the rest of you, I don't know what the problem is, but you need to do it. So, yeah, that's going to be a great, great way for us to. And remember, we've been talking about one of the things we've talked about lately is that the word justice in the Bible, this word justice, really means everybody having enough. And so to care about people in Africa having enough doesn't mean we don't care about people in Butler County having enough. We believe the message of Jesus wants us to do both. And so it's caring for the people among us right here in Butler County, in Morgantown, in this region. But it's also, there's plenty of God's love and blessing to go around. So it's also about caring about our brothers and sisters in Africa as well. I'll tell you what I told the folks at Salem last week, and it's a little better this week. I had some oral surgery. It'll be 2 weeks ago Monday. And so I have a newfound lisp that I didn't have before that I'm hoping will eventually be part of my history and not part of my present. But I'll try to be deliberate. I'll try to talk a little slower, and we'll make sure that we get through this. So we're continuing a series we've been in called Relationship Killers. And last week, Derek talked about untrustworthiness. Today, we're going to talk about apathy. And next week, we're going to wrap up the series by talking about faithfulness and unfaithfulness. And then on September 13th, which is the Sunday after Labor Day, we're going to start a new series called The 10 Words. And our buddy Josh Hampton's already created our graphic. It's on the 10 Commandments. Isn't that awesome? Isn't that awesome? And so we'll start a series on September 13th focused on the 10 Commandments, and we'll do that up until the time of Advent. So it'll take us through half of September, October, and part of November as well. Isn't that great? I asked him, I was like, could we get in copyright trouble for using Charlton Heston's picture? And he's like, let's hope so, because then everybody's going to know about it. So, you know, here we are. Just going for it. So let's have a word of prayer, and we'll jump right in. God, we are grateful for this morning, for this body and blood, wine and bread. We are grateful for this opportunity we've been given as a community to stand alongside some pretty wonderful people in the world to raise our voices and simply say that everybody needs enough. And we're grateful that we get to actually play a role, perhaps, in seeing Africa become electrified and the lives it will change and save. That's just such a beautiful, beautiful Jesus sort of thing to do. And we're so grateful to be a part of it. As we take a few moments and as we look at our relationships and as we think through the scripture and all that it means for us, it's just our prayer that the risen Christ would be among us and in us, guiding us, directing us, convicting us, comforting us, making us uncomfortable, whatever it is that we need today. We pray that we'll be just taking that next right step on the journey. We ask all these things in the strong name of Jesus. And everybody said, amen. Have you ever noticed how kids today, and I realized when I thought I was going to open the sermon like this, I think when you begin to say kids today, that's a sign. This will be a sign unto you that you're becoming old when you're talking about kids today. Have you noticed with kids today, though, they have much more technology than any of us did when we were kids. I remember when I was first, you know, little, we had an Atari, and I grew up playing Atari, like Pac-Man and Pong and some of those fun games, Galactica, I think, Space Invaders. I love Space Invaders. And we had an Atari, and I just thought it was the coolest thing. Then I remember, I think it was Father's Day of 85, we got our first Nintendo. And it came with that duck hunt game. You know what I'm talking about, with the gun where you shoot the ducks. And I would sit right up next to the screen, so I had the high score. And it came with Mario Brothers. But and then they came out with Game Boy, and that was pretty cool. But have you noticed with kids today, they have far more technology. I mean, for some of us, all we had were probably back in, you know, the early Iron Age or whatever, was a stick to drag behind us. I don't know what you had to play with. But you remember when Slinkies were big? You remember Slinkies? Now, can you imagine giving a kid today a Slinky? They'd be like, what is wrong with you? It's a piece of metal that's been wound up. What does it do? Kids today have the coolest toys. They have Kindle Fires, and they have Nintendo DSs, and they have access to Netflix. My kid watches, when we're driving down the road, he'll watch Curious George on our phones on Netflix while we're driving down the road. Kids today have the coolest toys. Their action figures are cooler than our action figures were. Sometimes I'll find myself in my boy's room going, I'm just going to play with these, and I don't care. I'm going to play with these. These are so much cooler than what I had. And inevitably, though, what will happen is when you know your kid will be playing with their video, whatever, and watching TV at the same time, and there's like 12 things going on at once, and then you'll hear this one phrase that comes out of their mouth. I'm what? Bored. Does that not make you want to go through the roof a little bit? You're bored. What do you mean you're bored? You're holding a television in your hands, watching it while we go to Chuck E. Cheese. How can you possibly be bored, right? There's this sense of like, you have nothing to be bored about. You're from morning till night, you're in a constant technological overflow. Your senses are always being stimulated by something. How can you be bored? How many of you have had that conversation with your kids? Anybody had that conversation? How can you possibly be bored? And here's the thing. That's not just a problem with kids, though. I think lots and lots of us are bored, too. We're in our routines, we're in our ruts, we're in our lives, and we've really just become super bored. And the word that gets associated with boredom, in my mind, is apathy, right? Because when you become so bored, it's like there's nothing that can fire you up, nothing that can engage you, nothing that can pull you back in. And so what I'm learning in my own relationships is that when we let apathy take control, it can begin to kill the relationship. And so today I want to focus on this idea of how do we, first of all, what is apathy? What can it do to us? And then what can we do in our relationships with God and each other that actually begins to sort of unwork some of the deadliness of apathy? So let's begin with a little word study. The word apathy, in Greek, it's the word apatheia. It means without feeling or without suffering, lacking interest or enthusiasm or engagement. So apathy is this general sense of disconnection. Right, it's when everything is going on around you. People are connecting. Good things are happening around you. Technology overall, and you're just kind of sitting back on the couch with a glazed look on your face, completely disengaged. You have no get up and go. It's just easier to sit on the couch by yourself and kind of just mold and let the couch mold around you than it is to actually get out and seek to engage. Now, I think we all go through times where perhaps it's because, maybe it's because we're depressed, maybe it's because we've been hurt in some way, and we'll talk a bit about that. But I think apathy is, there's like a temporary apathy, right? Where we just have a day, you ever have that day where you just feel like, I don't want to be around anybody, I don't want to do anything, I just want to be, and I don't even know that that's apathy. I think sometimes that's just called mental health, right? A day away from all the stresses and pressures, that's a good thing. But when apathy becomes your pattern of living, when you are completely disengaged from everything and everyone around you, it can actually do things to us, unhelpful things. And there's actually a word that is, I think, connected to this that we studied a couple years ago. We studied the seven deadly sins, which aren't necessarily in the Bible, but it comes out of church tradition and those sorts of things. These are the things that really are the deadliest. And one of those deadly sins was sloth. How many remember we talked about sloth? And I kind of sound like Sid the Sloth from, at least in my own head, from Ice Age. But, you know, where does the word sloth come from? It comes from these animals that, have you ever seen them at like a zoo? Do you know what they do? They just lay there. They don't really do anything. They're just kind of disconnected. They're not really involved in the, you know, people are looking at them, taking pictures of them. Other animals are in the cage, and they just kind of chill. And so Jeff Cook says this about sloth, and we'll use these words interchangeably, sloth and apathy. At its core, sloth moves us away from everything that ultimately matters and directs us towards simple distractions. Sloth is not mere laziness. Sloth is indifference. Indifference toward my soul, my neighbors, my world, or my God. Sloth is at its core, apathy at its core. It's not just being lazy. It's not like if you would just get up and do something, everything would be fine. It's a condition of the heart where you are just indifferent at the world around you. It's when you hear that there are, like, we could fix 70%. We could help erase 70% of the mother-child deaths in Africa, right? And you think, oh, I just can't really write a letter. The pen's so far, right? There's this sense of just complete indifference and complete disengagement. It's when you know, my goodness, I can make a difference in the world if I would just do it, and you choose not to because deep in your heart, indifference has taken root. We're talking about apathy. Now, apathy is not rest. I know lots and lots of people who, if they get a day off and they rest, they feel guilty. Has that ever been your experience? You get a day off and you stay in your pajamas till like 4 p.m. You don't take a shower. Hopefully you brush your teeth. You do nothing productive and you go to bed feeling guilty because I didn't produce today. That's not apathy. That's not sloth. That's not indifference. Apathy is not rest. We need rest. Our family, we've been in the process. Carla started a new job. We moved. I had this little oral surgery a couple weeks ago, and then I started teaching at Western this week, and our boys started kindergarten. In the past 3 weeks, that's been our lives. And we've been running. And I asked her this morning when we got up, I was like, what would it be like to get enough sleep? Because that's been sort of non-existent for us, right? What would it be like? So sloth, but that sloth is not getting rest. There's nothing wrong with rest. Rest is a good thing. Rest keeps you healthy. Rest keeps your mind in a good place. Rest keeps your body and physical health in a good place. Rest is a good needed thing. It's not stillness. Sometimes we need to be still. So now that we're in kindergarten, Cohen comes home every day and he sleeps on the way home in the car. He's just exhausted. But by the time he gets home, it's now this thing where he can't sit still. Like he's so wired up. And we're trying to eat dinner and he's like just doing this all over the, we have a little island in the middle of the kitchen and he's taking a bite and running around the island a few times and taking a bite and running around. And I'm like, do you do this at school? Do they allow you to do this? He's like, oh no, I sit down the whole time. And he's just moving. And I wish I had that energy, right? But there's nothing wrong with being still. Now, when you're 5 and you've got all that energy, pour it on. But when you become a grown-up and life takes a lot out of you and you're taking care of your kids and you're going to work and you're answering emails and you're dealing with difficult situations and you're helping maybe take care of an elderly family member, like at some point you need a moment just to be still, whether that's early on the back deck drinking a cup of coffee, watching the sun come up, however that, or maybe it's in the evening watching the sun, however that works for you, we need moments of stillness. How in the world do we ever expect to hear from God in any sort of significant way if we're never creating the time and stillness it takes to be present to hear from God? It's not reflection. I think we need more reflection in our world, not less. Like more thinking about what's going on in our lives, more processing it. I think the reason many of us walk around with all sorts of anger and bitterness and hurt is partly because things have happened to us that create anger and bitterness and hurt, but also partly because we never sit and think about it. We never pause and let the pain work on us. Now, there's a moment where that you do that too long and it creates more bitterness and anger. But there's a moment where you need to stop and actually feel what you feel. Right? It's not unbiblical or unchristian to allow to feel your feelings and think about, why do I feel this way? Why did what they say? I was in a situation last week where somebody said something to me, and I don't think they meant it like this, but when they said it, because this person was a close friend, it felt like I'd been hit by a Mack truck. Right? And I left the meeting we had together, and I was driving away, and I was just thinking, why did that hurt so badly? Why am I having trouble? Why am I replaying that? And the whole day, I'm just replaying what that person said over and over again. It was very, very painful. And eventually, we connected, and they explained themselves, and everything was fine. But the whole day, my mind was like, why? And I'm learning that that's important, because if I had just stuffed it and ignored it, resentment would have grown. In a very short amount of time, I could have become bitter. And so thinking about, why do I feel, now I don't always do that. And there's sometimes when I just kind of brush away because I'm supposed to be better than that. I'm supposed to be more mature than that. I'm supposed to be a Christian leader, whatever that means. And so I just, try to stuff it, and eventually it just creates more problems. Apathy is not reflection, and it's not play. Sometimes you just need to have a good time. You need to do things that bring you life. And I would connect that to Sabbath, right? Sabbath, and we'll look at that during the Ten Commandments, but Sabbath is essentially this gift to us that comes to us in the Bible that says, 6 days you work, 1 day you play. 6 days you give it your best, 1 day you do things that give you life. 6 days you pour yourself out into your work or into your world, and then on the seventh day you allow something to be poured back into you. And so, play is a good thing. Some of the best times we have are when we're together with our friends and our kids are all playing and we're talking or doing something fun together. Like that. And it doesn't matter how tired I am. Sometimes when I leave those gatherings with other people who I love and who love me, I feel like I have more energy. Like going to small group, for example, our small group meets on Sunday evening, and usually by the end of a Sunday, we're pretty wiped out. And I'll go to small group thinking, I am too tired for this. And then I'll get there, and at the end of it, Carla is saying to me what we say to Cohen. Can you not sit down? Why are you running around the kitchen? What? Stop. It gives me such life. And for me, that is just being with those people is life-giving. Laughing, eating, celebrating the goodness of God. That's not apathy, guys. We need to take that more seriously. We need to take regular breaks times, intervals that we protect fiercely, whether that's a couple hours on the evening or a whole day, whatever you can make happen. But where we protect this fiercely. This is our time to be re-energized, recharged with doing something we love, with people we love. And that's a gift from God. It's not something that's to be considered negative. So apathy is not that. Here's what apathy is. Apathy is indifference. Apathy is not caring, essentially. You see the pain and suffering of the world, and you're like, eh, what's for lunch, right? Apathy is disconnection. It's when you generally have allowed yourself to be disconnected from everything good and life-giving in the world. Apathy is disengagement. It's boredom. It's boredom. Can you imagine in the world God has made any human being looking around going, there's just nothing to do here? Can you imagine? We're about to move into the best season of all seasons. We're about to move into fall. People are already throwing footballs around. People are already making fires at night. It's like 50 degrees in the evening sometimes, 50-some degrees. It's just the perfect time of year. And growing up in the mountains like I did of eastern Kentucky, I was trained to love watching the leaves turn color. Like, if you can look at creation and feel bored by the whole thing, then that's not really a problem with God or the world. That's a problem with us. There's plenty of good to do. There's plenty of good things in God's world to be a part of and engage with. But ultimately, apathy is the failure to use our God-given energies for something that matters. Apathy is when we put all of our, what little energy we're willing to spend, we put it into distractions, things that ultimately don't matter a hill of beans in the world. And apathy is when we fail to use our God-given, you have God-given energies, God-given creativity, God-given passions. You have things that are in you that aren't in anyone else in the world like they're in you. You are a unique creation. And apathy is when you take all this unique creativity and passion and longing for how the world should be. It's every good thing God put in you. And you just say, eh, not really feeling it today. I'm going to go back to bed. Or, eh, I'm not really feeling it. I'm going to go through the motions and I'm going to go through my routine. But I'm not going to give it my best. I'm not even going to connect. I'm not going to try to connect with anybody else. I'm just going to live in my own little indifferent sort of world. Will Willimon says sloth or apathy is that couch potato dullness where the eyes glaze over and the heartbeat slows to a thud and the creative human made in the image of God becomes indistinguishable from a slug. Isn't that great? Apathy is when every good thing God has put in you, you ignore it, disconnect from it, stuff it, and the creative human made in the image of God becomes indistinguishable from a slug. By the way, have you ever seen a slug up close in person? It is not something you want to be compared to. Apathy is deadly to our relationships. Apathy is a general disinterest. I think apathy sometimes comes from being spoiled or desensitized, right? So why do kids who have all the technology in the world, why are they bored? Because eventually, when you're used to a certain amount of stimulation, eventually it's not enough anymore and you need more, right? This is true of drugs often, right? Like you get a little bit and it's not enough, so you need more. And I think we think about, these things over here are drugs and they're bad for you. But over here, having the same experience over technology or whatever, that's not bad for you. That's normal. Right? Anything that you allow to desensitize you to the goodness and blessing you've been given in your life becomes a problem. And I think there are far more of us grown-ups who are spoiled than kids ever thought of being. Perhaps we're spoiled to our standard of living and we're no longer grateful. We no longer feel gratitude toward God and the people who helped us get where we are. And so we live our lives with a sense of entitlement and expectation of you owe me, God, you owe me, people, you owe me. And instead of saying I've been given so many blessings and opportunities that outside of God and the people in my life who gave me those opportunities, I'd never have had those. Right? Perhaps you become spoiled and desensitized and you no longer live with a sense of gratitude. I've seen this happen in church too, right? Because what begins to happen is sometimes, like I think at our church, we're really blessed by having lots and lots of talented people who do things for us. And I can remember sometimes leaving church and thinking, you know, I didn't get that feeling today I was looking for. That's what I grew up being taught to look for at church, was that feeling. You know that feeling like where the hair on the back of your neck gets all stands up and gets all tingly and you just feel like this was so, and that's an emotional thing and that's fine. But there's a point where we become so spoiled by the goodness we've been given, by the talent of the people leading us, and that we come in expecting, what are you going to do for me today? Instead of thinking, my goodness, we get a chance to be together. Do you see what I'm saying? And very early on in my time here, what we began to realize is we were creating, by trying to do so much and make a spectacle out of Sunday morning, what we ended up doing is we created a self-devouring system where we were constantly trying to wonder how to one-up what we did last week. And so, like, at what point do I ride in on a motorcycle with a helmet on fire? You know what I mean? Like, it comes down to, like, if we're going to create a spectacle, at what point is it so great and so big that we can no longer afford to do it, or it's just no longer possible anymore, and it becomes absurd, right? Can you imagine if I, like, came in from the roof or something, or up from the, like, do we put a trap door here and let me come out with a fog machine going and, you know, kind of have an Elvis sort of jumpsuit on? Like, what do we do to keep one-upping it? And we just decided, you know what, at some point we just have to stop and say, we're going to get together and we're going to sing some songs together, not because we need to be entertained, but because we need to have a voice together to sort of express where everybody's at. And then we're going to hear some teaching, and then we're going to go out into the world and actually put it into practice. Right? Because there's a certain point where we just keep one-upping, keep one-upping, keep one-upping, and it's really, really cool. But at some point, the substance gets lost in the flash. And so, you know, what do we do about that? So we try to pull back. There's a difference in being content and complacent, by the way. Being content is a good thing. Realizing that what we have is what we have, and it's enough. And that God has been good to us, and that our friends are good to us. Like, that's a good thing. Being content is a good thing. I think sometimes we can almost confuse that with being complacent. Being complacent means you're not willing to do anything. You're just happy where you are. You're happy with how things are, and you're not willing to engage to make things that aren't okay different anymore. And I think in lots and lots and lots of Christian circles and churches, there tends to be lots of complacency, lots of let somebody else do it, right? This sort of sense like, I've put in my time, I've done my duty. 30 years ago, I taught Sunday school and I didn't hurt one single child, and that was my gift to God and the church. And now I'm not going to do anything anymore, right? This sense of complacency that is not what God has created you to have. God made you as a passionate, creative human being to join him in the ongoing healing and restoration of the world, not to be complacent. And then there's this sense, it's just like a lack of initiative. It's when I say this sometimes about things, and you can say this about any area, religion, politics, something. You know, somebody ought to do something about that. You ever said that about anything? Somebody ought to do something about that. And then when the person you're talking to says, okay, do something about it, and you're like, well, I didn't mean me. I miss somebody else, right? There's a general lack of initiative with apathy. If there's a problem in the world and you have a good idea for it, it's not somebody else's job to implement your idea. It's your job to say, now how can I use my God-given energies and abilities to join God in the ongoing healing and restoration of all things? Like, that's your job, not somebody else's job. So there's this general lack of initiative. And apathy is often something that takes hold slowly over time. You ever met somebody on their first day of work and how excited they are about it and how energetic they are, and they can't wait, and they're going to go in and they're going to make a change, and it's going to happen and it's going to be good, and then you meet them 5 years later and it's like, oh my God, I have to go to work today. You know what I mean? There's this, it's over time apathy happens. Apathy in relationships, for example, it usually doesn't set in on the honeymoon in a marriage, right? When does apathy take place? It begins to take root when lives and routines and maybe kids come into the picture, and you're going 90 miles an hour, and suddenly there's a general lack of interest in bringing your relationship to new levels and new life and new closeness, and you're just trying to keep your head above water. And suddenly the idea of putting more time in the relationship because you're already exhausted by everything else, it just seems like, why in the world would I bother? How does apathy happen in friendships? I remember the friends I had in college. I thought, we're going to be best buddies until we die. And we have all grown and changed in so many ways. And I don't think some of us could be in the same room with each other without going crazy. And we just didn't keep up with each other. Right? I mean, we've all moved away. We all did our own thing. And so over time, those text messages, well, we didn't do that back then, but those phone calls or that, hey, I'm in town, let's get together for dinner, those things begin to kind of just dwindle away. And suddenly those friendships that you thought were so important now are no longer part of your lives. And apathy can be a response that seeks to shield us against the hurts and wounds that we've been carrying with us. You've been hurt, you've been wounded, somebody over here hurt you, and now the idea of engaging in another relationship, another close friendship, and maybe another romantic, whatever that looks like, somebody's hurt you, and the idea of ever being able to let somebody close again becomes too painful, and so you just kind of disengage, disconnect, and you exist only in yourself, and you no longer use your God-given gifts and abilities to do good things in the world. Now, at some point, I want to get to the Bible because that's really important, because the ultimate problem with apathy is that it keeps us from engaging in the work God has for us. Jesus was very specific about this. Jesus was very specific about God having some things for us to do in the world. Notice how toward the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is talking to people about, again, about who's really blessed and who's really well off. And he begins with the poor and the meek and those who've been trampled and persecuted and those who are hungry and thirsty for the world to be made right in a world that's not made right. And then Jesus says to his followers this: you are the light of the world. A city on top of a hill can't be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a basket. Instead, they put it on top of a lampstand, and it shines on all who are in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before people so that they can see the good things you do and praise your Father who is in heaven. All right, Jesus uses this idea of light, and the Jewish people had long talked about how they were the light of the world. And Jesus uses this image of light, and this is not a very bright light, or I would turn all the lights out right now. But Jesus uses the image of light, and he says, "This you are the light of the world." Now, if that you is singular, you're going to have to really work hard to shine bright, right? But he's using that you in plural, so he's saying to his community of disciples, you are the light of the world. And when you go into the world, your job is to shine your light in such a way that people around you see your lives. Not hear your doctrine, not listen to your dogma, not read the little tract you left on the wet bathroom counter in the restroom in a public place, which you should never pick up, by the way. Like, not that sort of thing. He's saying people should see how you live, how you treat your neighbor, how you care about those who can do nothing for you. What do you do for people who can do nothing for you? That's a Jesus sort of question. How do you serve those who can never give back what you've given them and serve them without expectation? Right? Jesus says, let your light shine. And he says, you don't light a lamp and put it in a house and cover it up. Because in Jesus' day, if you cover up a wick, and in our day too, we just don't use a lot of non-battery powered light anymore. But what happens when you cover up and you cut off the oxygen from a candle flame? What does it do? It dies. It dies. And I think what Jesus is getting at is there's lots of ways we can fail to shine our light. I think one of the ways we can do it is just by doing things that aren't very Jesus-like. So it's not loving our enemies. That's a pretty clear way to cover up your light, right? It's not caring about the poor. That's a pretty clear way to cover up your light. It's being judgmental, self-righteous, and essentially rude to everybody who doesn't agree with you. That's a way to cover up your light. I think another way we cover up our light is just through general apathy. It's not that we don't want to do, maybe it's not even that we think Jesus was probably right about these things. We're just not going to engage and do anything about it. Maybe we're going to come in and sit for our hour and 15 minute service and you know, sing some songs, take some bread, take some wine, hear a sermon, and go out. And we've done our duty. We've given God our hour and 15, right? And when we do that, our apathy extinguishes and suffocates the light of God in us. I have come to believe if you truly are seeking to follow Jesus, your life will not become less complicated, it will become more complicated. Things will not be more black and white, they will be more gray than ever, many times. The people you used to want to write off, you can no longer write off anymore. The people you used to want to have bad things happen to them, you can no longer long for bad things to happen to them. Following Jesus and taking this light deal seriously, it actually complicates life in big ways, but it also brings more goodness and healing to the world. How many of you watch the news? How many of you ever ask yourself why when you're done watching the news? If you think about the headlines we've had in our world in the past 6 months, senseless deaths, economic crises all over the world, violence. And we wonder, and we think, somebody ought to do something about that. And Jesus has already given us, your job is to shine your light. Somebody can do something about this. And the reason I don't just wake up every day and think, I got to get back in the bed because there's no good in the world. What I wake up every day thinking is, I think Jesus was actually right. And I think if we do what Jesus said, the world can be different. I think if we love our enemies, the world could be different. I think if we show compassion to those who in our terms don't deserve it, I think the world can be different. I think if we care about the poor, the world can be different. And Jesus says, don't suffocate your lamp, whether it's through actions, things you do that aren't very Jesus-like, or I would even say, and I think Jesus would agree, inaction. Just becoming a slothful, apathetic slug of a human being suffocates the light in us. One more text, and then we'll wrap up. This is from a writer later in Christian tradition. It's from the book of Ephesians. You are saved by God's grace because of your faith. This salvation is God's gift. It's not something you possessed. It's not something you did that you can be proud of. Isn't that good news? Like, I'm convinced people don't need to have their mistakes rubbed in their faces anymore. People don't need to have more and more guilt and shame heaped on them. You know what people need to be told? People need to be told about the boundless, limitless grace of God, which is already ours. Not once we jump through the right hoops and sign the right paperwork. It's already yours. And that's what the writer of Ephesians is saying. God's gift to you is grace. Not earned grace, not deserved grace. Free, abundant, limitless grace. Grace for every mistake. Grace for every slip up. Grace for everything. Grace. And then he says this. Instead, we are God's accomplishment. The literal Greek there is really like masterpiece or work of art. Created in Christ Jesus to do good things. God planned these good things to be the way that we live our lives. You are God's artwork. You are a God. You're a piece of work is essentially what the writer of Ephesians is saying. You're God's handiwork. You are this good, creative, beautiful, image-bearing thing God has made to live in the world. And when God put you here, God put you here with the idea that you would join God in making the world better. Because even though lots and lots of Christians have given up on the world being better, the good news is God hasn't. Do you ever talk to people like that? Like, the world's just, it's just supposed to get worse and worse and worse. That's a bad story, isn't it? That's an awful story. That's not a God story. That's a human story. A God story is, no, things don't have to get worse and worse and worse. God can actually, through us, shine light, bring hope. He can send his pieces of work out into the world to do good things that bring about the love and kingdom and justice of God in a real, practical way. Isn't that good news? I mean, do you see why they call this good news? It's not because there are more and more hoops to jump through. It's because God is essentially inviting us to be a part of something that's going on that is not dependent on our ability or our goodness. It's dependent on God's grace and love and empowerment. That's a good, good thing. So I want to just focus on two groups of people real quick. I want two relationships, and then we'll go. One is, Jesus said the greatest commandment is to love God and love people. Like, these are the two things that, if we do nothing else right, do these two things. Love God with your whole being and love your neighbor as yourself. This is what we've been told to do. So if we think about our relationship with God and we think about apathy, what happens when we are apathetic toward God? I think our capacity to love our neighbor well in some ways suffers because our soul begins to shrink. When we allow ourselves to believe that the world is doomed, that there's no good, that God really isn't good, that God isn't on our side, that God isn't working to make the world a better, more whole, healed place, like we become smaller internally. And less able to see the goodness of God in the world. And we talked about this. Remember the Sunday, if you were here, we had the fishbowl up here, and we had the fish in the fishbowl. We were talking about, what do we mean by the word God? And we said that God is like the water, and we're like the fish. That God is always, in God we live and move and have our being. Right? It's not just that God is in everything, it's that everything is in God. And so this idea that we can't escape God, but yet we can totally miss God around us. I'm one of those people who I'm oblivious to everything. So you could put, you could like a couple weeks ago, this tree out here got blown over by wind. Have you seen the tree out on the side of the building out here? It's dying. It's got blown over by the wind. I work here and I saw it last week and it happened like 3 weeks ago. Like, so that's me oblivious. I think we could become oblivious to God. Borg says it like this. The relational vision of life with God is analogous in an important way to human relationship. It grows and deepens to the extent that we pay attention to it. It involves attending to the relationship, spending time in it, being intentional and thoughtful about it, valuing it, and ideally enjoying it. How do we grow in our relationship with God? Well, let's talk about people. How do you grow in your relationship with people? Now, when it comes to God, sure, we can read the Bible and we can pray and we can go to church, but I think there are other things we can also do. Like, we can just try to be aware of the presence of God in every moment of life. That God is always there, always with us, that we cannot, as the psalmist says, there's nowhere we can go to escape God's presence. God is always with us, right? But what do we do on a human level? How do we deepen and intensify our relationships? And I would say, I would just say three things. And these are three things I'm not very good at right now that I'm working on and I struggle with. First of all, we practice intentionality. Relationships don't grow and deepen accidentally. It doesn't happen through like osmosis, right? If you have a deep connection with a spouse or a good friend, how did that happen? You have built that over time. You've been through stuff together. And probably you make that relationship important in your life. And here's how you show it's important. Sometimes you say no to other things to say yes to this. One yes is like 1,000 no's. And so when you say yes to this person, this friend, this spouse, this partner, when you say yes to that person, you're essentially saying at times no to 1,000,000 other good things. But you practice intentionality. You prioritize it. For some of us, if we want our friendships to deepen, we need to put a lunch date on the calendar and protect it fiercely. If you want your marriage to grow, then you need to spend regular time. And I know we all love our kids, but sometimes you need to spend time without changing diapers and feeding babies. You need to have time with just you and your partner to actually engage and deepen and spend some time together. And just remember what it was like before you had all the responsibilities and everything else, and it was just the two of you. That's an important, healthy sort of thing. And then be present when you're present. And in our age, I struggle with this. I know so many of us do. How many of you have ever been to lunch with somebody and you're sitting at the table and you're both on your phones? And you're talking to people maybe 3 states away, but the person who's right in the same room with you, you're totally ignoring. The first day of classes was Tuesday, and I was headed up. My class meets at 12:45, and I was headed up the stairs at Cherry and when the other class got out. And I almost got ran over by a stampede of college students, all of whom were doing this while they walked down the stairs. I don't know how they do that. If I were doing that while I walked down the stairs, you would be like this. I don't know how they were doing it, but we created a culture, and I'm as much a part of it as anybody else, who were with people, but we're not with people. And perhaps it's not even technology. Perhaps you're carrying around all sorts of other things you're thinking about. And when you're with these people, your mind's really somewhere else. Right? It's not just what happens with your fingers. It's what's happening in your head. So it's being present when you're present. Be with the people you're with. There'll be times to Facebook. There'll be times to Snapchat, which I just learned about recently. There'll be times to Twitter. There'll be times to think about that conversation you need to have, to think about that project that needs to be finished. But when you're with these people, be with these people. And I hope if you see me at lunch with somebody and I'm doing this, you'll just smack me in the back of the head and say, be here. Get it. Get with the program. Because our relationships, we can be in the same room with somebody every day and our relationship could be in atrophy because we're not paying attention. Does that make sense? So ultimately, if we want thriving relationships that aren't apathetic, it begins with just opening our eyes and seeing one another and being with one another and making that a central priority of our lives. We do what matters. We prioritize what matters. We focus on what matters. Let's pray. God.